We're really at a spot right now, and if you're not aware of it, we had three of our elders on our pastoral team, our eldership, go to a conference down in Medford by a church that's really doing a fantastic job of making disciples, not just getting people to come to church, but really saying, hey, you know, like Stephen read from Luke 9, discipleship involves certain things, like carrying your cross. It involves your whole life. So we were at a conference talking about, okay, what are you guys doing and what can we take away from what you're doing to help people, help us all figure out how to follow Jesus more closely. And so this is certainly going to be a part of it. And in the months to come, particularly in the new year, we're going to have a better idea about what that looks like, okay? We're going to have a better idea of what those first couple of steps for following Jesus at our church is going to look like. And this is certainly going to be involved in it as we go there. So just be mindful of that. Please use that for your own study. Use that if you want to kind of gather some people together and get that process going. We're in Luke 15, and Luke 15 is one of those places that you probably know the story fairly well. But in fact, we might not know the story very well. It's the story of what's typically called the story of the prodigal son in Luke 15, 11 through 32. And your Bible probably has it actually, there's probably a subheading on there. It says the prodigal son, right? Right above verse 11 there. What we're going to find, though, is this story is not about the prodigal son. This story is about a father. We've said that a couple times, haven't we? This story is about a father, and it's about a father with two lost sons, not just a prodigal son, but he has two lost sons. And so what we're going to do this week is kind of break the ice in this story, and then the next 2 weeks, we're going to look at the younger son and the older son and say, how are these sons lost? Because they're both lost. They're lost in unique ways. One is lost, as we'll see here shortly, in a certain sort of circumstances that we probably know about. But there's another son that's very lost as well. And the father does some things to try to bring his sons from being lost to being found. Okay? So this isn't just about the prodigal son. This is about a father. And we'll see how that really works out here shortly. My daughter, as we were walking to church this beautiful Sunday morning, my daughter said something that I wanted to include in this morning's time together. I thought it was very insightful. Ada is incredibly insightful. She said, Papa, what are you going to be preaching on? And I said, well, what do you care? You're not going to be in there, so I can talk all day, right? She said, well, what are you going to be preaching on? And I said, well, do you remember the story of the father and the two lost sons? And she said to me, and this is where it gets really cool, she said, Dad, Papa, is that a fiction story or not? And that's why these stories are powerful, isn't it? Because you and I know, if you read at all, and I know reading's kind of like not cool anymore, but if you read, you know that fiction is actually some of the most real stuff there is, right? Because even though it's just a story, what we find in fiction is we find ourselves, don't we? We find the world, we find history, we find people trying to wrestle with what's really going on and doing it in a creative sort of a way. So I sit there and I as I'm trying to respond to my daughter when she says, is that story fiction? I was a little remiss. I didn't know how to answer. Why? Because on the one hand, this is a story about, it's a fictional story. It's a story that Jesus tells, right? And yet on the other hand, it's just not, is it? It's a story that encapsulates deep truths about real things, about the world and about God and about Jesus and about us. So is it a fictional story? I just had to kind of say, I don't know, honey. It's a story that Jesus tells, and as we're looking over these next several stories, to give us a new vantage point, a new angle, a new perspective on how to see the world and everything in it, okay? This is a story that might involve all of us, because this is a story about a father, and not all of you guys are fathers. There's a lot of, as I'm looking around, I've got a lot of dads, got a lot of grandfathers in the room. So you're going to maybe resonate with the dad or one of the sons in the story. But if you're not a father, you have a father. Everybody is either a dad or has a dad. And this is going to be maybe a challenging story because some of you have a dad that you look up to and you love him. And it's just, when you think of your dad, it's a pretty fitting reflection of the love of God. And for some of you, just saying the word dad or father, you can't even bring yourself to do it because it's so maybe painful or it's such a disconnect. And so maybe you've had a really hard time getting a grasp on calling God your father, like Jesus instructs us to in his prayer in Matthew 6. You know, start out, our Father. So this story, it's going to encapsulate all of us because it's about a dad, okay? We're all either dads or we have a dad. And so this story is essentially about God, and it's really essentially about us. Let me say one more thing before we jump into the fiction, nonfiction, transformational story that Jesus tells. If you're a dad here in the room, let me ask you this question. Have your kids ever done something to disappoint you? Something where, you know, maybe it was like I see, and we're starting to get into this too, but like, have you ever done something like in public, like at school or at church or at the Christmas program, and you're kind of like, oh my goodness, it's my kid, you know? Like they disappoint you, and it's not like heartbreak, you go home and you know you flail them or anything, but it's just something where you go, oh man, this is not one of my prouder moments. Disappointment, right? Have they ever done that to you? Okay, well, let me take it another, let's take it way farther. Has your kids ever broken your heart? Not just like, oh, that was bad, but we're going to get over it, but like, you know, you couldn't breathe. Like, I can't believe my kid did that. I can't believe my kid just said that to me. Like, you're so shocked, you're so broken, you don't even know what to do. Like, breathing, right? That kind of thing. And if that were the case, how did you go about possibly winning the heart of your son or daughter back to you? Because you were so disappointed, you saw what they did, and it broke your heart, but you realized, man, my kid is broken. If they're going to do that, my kid, they're veering off track. They're doing something they're not supposed to. If they keep going down that track, oh my goodness, that's going to end in very, very dark places. If you thought about, they broke my heart, they're on a path of destruction, what am I going to do to win them back? Is there anything I can do to get them back? If you've thought any of those things as a dad, as broken as we are, this story is going to give us a window into who God is and what He does to win us back. Because this story essentially says that there's a father that has two sons and both of them break their father's heart. Okay? Enough of me. Let's let Jesus have the floor. Notice what it says in verse 11. And He said, there was a man. Notice this is a story about a man. This is a story about a father who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. And he divided his property between them, between him and the other son. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all that he had, and he took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into the fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise, I will go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. Just make me an employee, in other words. And he arose and he came to his father. He had a plan. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and he came and he drew near to the house. He heard music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked him what these things meant. And he said to him, your brother has come. Your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. But he was angry and he refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, look, these many years I have served you. I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you never even gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who's devoured your property with prostitutes, you kill the fattened calf for him. And he said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. Now I ask the question, is this story fiction or is it nonfiction? Well, again, the answer I think probably is both. Because what we find in this story is we find us. We find us. And what we find is that there's more than one way to break a father's heart. Okay? The story of the prodigal son certainly illustrates, and we're going to focus on him next week. We're just kind of laying the groundwork this morning. The story of the prodigal son shows us that there's one way to break a father's heart, and that's by being incredibly bad. I don't know of too many fathers who, when their son is being incredibly wickedly bad, they're going, "That's my boy." You know, and maybe in some cases, for sure. But in most cases, right, when a son in public or whatever is doing something that's against sort of the cultural norm, they're doing something that's against what everybody would say is honorable. If they do something incredibly bad or they go off the deep end, as it were, what we like to say, that breaks a father's heart. So the prodigal son illustrates that the first way to break a father's heart is by being incredibly bad. But what we find in the story of the father is that there's actually another way to break our father's heart. And you know what it is? It's surprising. We can break our father's heart, I think Connie just said it, by being incredibly what? Good. We can break our father's heart in the midst of being incredibly good. And we're going to see in 2 weeks how good people are the hardest people to save. Okay, being good can actually, if you're pursuing goodness apart from grace, it's going to push you farther and farther away from grace, because when God extends it to people who don't deserve it, we get mad. Why? Because we use our goodness to kind of put God in our debt, so to speak. And I don't want to give that sermon away, but I just want to tell you that's where we're going. This text shows us that we can break our father's heart by being very, very bad, and we can break our father's heart, paradoxically, in the midst of being very, very good. Now, who in the world is this story for? What's the context of this story? And that's actually very important. We would find the context in the very first two verses of the chapter. This is the third story that Jesus has told in a sequence. This is really the climax of these stories that he's told. Notice the first couple of verses to this chapter. Just get, if you need to flip your Bible or whatever, go to Luke 15 and look at the first two verses. Notice the context that leads Jesus to tell these three stories, the third of which we just read, climaxing the point that he's trying to make. Notice who he's telling this story for. It says, "Now the tax collectors and the sinners were all drawing near to him." Right? All the bad people, the tax collectors, the sinners, they were all drawing near to him. And notice the response from the good people, the religious people. And the Pharisees, the scribes, the lawyers, the people that do the religious stuff, they know the law, they know God's word, they go to church, they do all that stuff. The Pharisees and the scribes grumbled. They grumbled. They said, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So this story is told in the context of Jesus accepting and receiving bad people and spending time with them. Eating with them is paramount, is equal to saying, "I want to be your friend. I want to break the ice here. I want to get to know you. I'm not just going to close my door to you. I want to get to know you. I want to know what's going on here." And the bad people are flocking to Jesus, okay? And the good people, rather than going, "Oh, that is a good thing," the bad people are going to Jesus. They need help. Their response is actually quite opposite. It says that they grumble. They talk under their breath. They're disappointed in Jesus because of the fact that the bad people are around him. And quite frankly, they're disgusted because he's accepting them. He's not pushing them back. Okay? So this story is not ultimately meant to be told for bad people. This isn't a story that we should find ourselves going, "Oh, this story is for me. I'm a bad person, okay? And I'm the prodigal son." And that could be very true. If you resonate with the prodigal, amen. God the Father loves you. We'll talk about that next week for sure. But this story is actually about the elder brother. And we can say that because of the context in verses 1 and 2. Because Jesus is telling this story in the context of good people grumbling over the fact that Jesus is accepting bad people. Okay, so this is going to be a little tough, and in 2 weeks, we might feel a little uncomfortable. This story is maybe for people just like us. At our conference, and I don't think this is happenstance, I don't think this is coincidence, We were talking about discipleship, and we were in small group settings discussing, lo and behold, Luke 15, 11 through 32. And one of the guys leading the workshop, he said, "So are you preaching tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, I'm a pastor, probably, yeah." And he said, "What are you preaching on?" And I said, "Well, what we just talked about." And he goes, "Coincidence? I don't think so," right? This is a story, right, that this is a story that we're going to find ourselves somewhere in this story. And if you don't have to be like me, okay, but if you're in this story and you're finding yourself being the elder brother, this story stings a little bit, right? If you're finding yourself as the younger brother, maybe this story stings a little, but you're going to find yourself as one of those sons. In fact, you might find yourself in the story now as the prodigal son. And in 5 years, you might find yourself as the elder brother. And that's what I've experienced. In my experience with walking with Jesus, the love of God, I know how wicked I am. I know how bad I am. And God loves me. And I go, "Why would you love me? I know what I've done. I know what I've thought. I know what I could do if left to my own devices." And so I just crumble under the love of God as He embraces me. And yet after being embraced for a long time and getting into church and getting into ministry and developing genuine goodness because of God's saving grace in my life, there's a tendency for us who've been in church for a long time to forget that we were a prodigal, and then not just be a prodigal, but to edge into becoming what? Becoming the elder brother. Okay? So if you're here this morning, you're going, "Well, I'm not the prodigal." Well, there's only two options. And we're not the father. Okay? One of the things that's hard about the parables is, and I love this about the way Jesus tells stories, is just when you think you're this person, Jesus turns the story to say, "No, you're not that person. You're one of these two guys." Okay? You're one of these two guys. The story divides us up into good people and bad people, but we can break the father's heart by being either very bad or very good, and we'll explore that over the next couple of weeks. But the question that I threw out early as we got together this morning and got into this story is, if you're a father and your son or daughter has broken your heart, or they've disappointed you, and you thought, what can I do? Is there anything I can do to make this right? You know, they've done something that just, you know, you thought to yourself, and boy, this is a tough one. You thought to yourself, "I didn't train them that way. I thought I raised you better than that." I mean, have you ever thought those things? You go, "I didn't. Who did that? Who messed this all up?" Right? "I thought I trained you better than that." They disappoint you. They break your heart. Thinking, "Is there anything I could have done? Is there anything I messed up doing? And is there anything I could do from here?" Right? The story of the Father shows us what we might be able to do. Because the Father does something incredible to both of these sons. In fact, He does something so radical. He shames himself for both of his sons to try to bring them back to himself. He enters into their shame to try to win them back to himself. It doesn't sound like much, and we'll talk about it more next week as we focus in on the prodigal. But notice what happens when the prodigal comes home. The prodigal comes home. He's come to himself. He's got a plan. He's coming home. And as he's a long ways off, the father sees him. Now that's important, because what does it imply? It means the father's looking for him. It means it's his father has kept open the possibility of his son's return. He hasn't just gone back to work. He hasn't just done his own thing. He's lived in the reality of, man, maybe rather than just writing his kid off, he said, "You know what, maybe my son will come home." And he's looking for the son to return. And in doing that, when he sees this raggedy old kid coming down the street, he does something so undignified, he does something so counterculture, and we miss it because we don't get it. He runs. That might sound like a lot. Yeah, if I saw my kid doing that, I would run. See, not in first century culture. In first century culture, for an elderly man to run was one of the most undignified things you could do. It would involve doing something like pulling up your robes and showing your legs that haven't gotten sun for maybe 30 years. In a lot of cultures, you know, I remember when I went down to South America, down to Guyana, the men in the culture were the most dignified, and they didn't do anything. They don't cook, they don't clean, they don't run, they have people doing everything for them. I mean, everything kind of revolves around them, so they can kick up their feet, they can do their thing, because they're kind of the king of their family, they're king of their company, all of that. This father does something so undignified, he runs. and he lifts up the hem on his long robe, and he shows his nasty legs, and he runs. And everybody's, what's that guy running? We don't run in this culture. We don't do that. And he runs, and he just totally shames himself to show his son. He's willing to shame himself to bring his son back into his love. So he enters into his son's shame. He voluntarily shames himself and enters into that with his son to try to win him back and to show him how much he loves him. He does something shaming as well for the older son. He when he finds out that the older son isn't going to come into the party, in first century culture, what he typically would do is he'd say, I'll take care of him later. In fact, servant, you go back there and you go put him in time out, or you tell him, you know what, if you're not going to come in and welcome your son back, you're out of the family. You know, I've thrown a party, we're celebrating, and you think you can just dig in your heels and not come in? The father should not be put in a position where he has to get uncomfortable and do something that should shame him. And yet the father, exactly what he does. He says, you know what, my older son's not going to come in. And what does the text say? If you've got it in front of you, what does the father do? Rather than saying, well, if my son's not going to come in, I'm not going to play that game. I'm going to stay right here too, and we're going to have a party. No, what does he do? He gets up from the table. Everybody's watching. What's the father doing? Father doesn't, he stays at the head of the tables. He's the one throwing the party. He's dignified. Da-da-da. No. The father gets up, and everybody knows where he's going. He's going out to talk to the elder son? Why would he do that? That means that he's letting the elder son have power over him. That means he's letting the elder son dictate the way this party's going to go. And the father says, I know, but I want him in the party. And I'm going to do whatever it takes to get him into the party. So he stands up awkwardly as the party, and everything quiets down. And everybody looks at him. Where are you going? And everybody knows where he's going. He's going out to, as the text says, entreat his son to try to get him back into the party. Something that a first century father would never do. He would never let his son control him that way. He would never let his son talk to him that way. He would never let his son reject this offer that way for another family member. And yet the father shames himself to try to win the older son back and to get him into the party. Either way, and we'll explore those details a little bit more, what the father does is instructive and it's powerful because it's a window into who Jesus is. That God himself, the Father, and as he's displaying his love for us in Jesus, he's saying, the way God works, the way the Father's work, the way that the Father works, is he's willing to enter into our shame to win our hearts back. He's willing to shame himself, to enter into the shame of his son and his daughter, to possibly win them back. And this is a risky thing. Because I don't know if you've ever done this as a father or as a mother. Have you ever had your son or your daughter do something so shaming and you're like, you're on your own, buddy. Like, I'm not a part of that. That's not the family name, right? Right? You put distance between yourself. Say, nope, that's not what we do here. What we see in this story, remember, this isn't just a story. This is a picture of God's love. This is a picture of Jesus. In Luke 9 that Stephen just read, Jesus points his face to the cross. These stories are told in a non-fictional setting. Jesus is going to die, right? It's told in the story of his passionate love for the world, for people, okay? So this story about the Father's love, Jesus is going to personify in his very death on the cross, which is an illustration of what? It's an illustration of the Father's willingness to enter into the shame of his son and daughter to possibly win their heart back. And there's no guarantee. How many of the sons enter back into the father's love? Do they both? No, they don't. There's just no guarantees when you enter into the shame of your son or daughter to try to win their heart back. But that's the only way. The only way we can maybe get their heart back, you know, have some influence in their life, is not to put distance between them and ourselves. It's to enter into what they've done, stand alongside them in it, to possibly gain the rapport, to possibly gain the influence, to possibly gain the ability to speak back into their life, to have a moral ground, to actually say something, to speak something powerful into life. But it's not going to happen if we don't enter into their shame with them, like the Father does. Because that's exactly what Jesus does. Jesus enters into our shame to provide an opportunity to maybe win our hearts back. But there's no guarantee. Because we're all in here, and there's a lot of us who we've given our heart back to the Father. Maybe there's some of us in here who are thinking about it, and there's some of us who are very far from it. And that's up to you. That's up to us. That's your decision to make. But know that God has willingly entered into your and my and our shame in his Son Jesus to provide an opportunity to win our hearts back. I think about that as a dad. And I think about the fact that we have a lot of dads in here. If we were to maybe translate that, maybe that would mean if we've been transformed by the love of Jesus. You know, when we do things and our father goes, oh man, that's not how that was supposed to go, or that's not what I'm about, or whatever. If I look at that love that God shows me, if we look at that love that God shows us, and we really translate that into our lives, and we let that transform us, I think it might mean that we do the very same thing to our kids. That we enter into a teen pregnancy with them rather than doing what we want to do, which is tie it off, put distance between us and say, nope, that's you, that's not us, that's not me, that's you. But if we see the love of the Father, what would we do? We'd say, you messed up, and I'm going to, and that wasn't something, you know, if we're trying to raise people to follow Jesus and then submit their sexuality to Jesus, we'd say, you know what, I tried to show you better, I tried to train you better, but I'm not going to put distance. I'm going to enter into your shame with you. We're going to do this together. I'm going to do that so I could maybe have the ability to speak the gospel back into your heart. And because I love you. I'm not going to let you do this by yourself. So maybe we enter into a teen pregnancy with our daughter, and we don't put distance between them and ourselves. Or pick your poison. Pick the thing that you can think, man, that would be so shameful. Pick the thing that, and maybe you've had the experience where you just go, nope, no, son or daughter, I don't enter into bankruptcy with my kids. Sorry, that's you. And maybe they do need to pay a little bit of the price for that, right? That's their decision, that's their issue, whatever. And you don't need to put the bill, but you also don't need to put distance between ourselves and them. Sorry, no, that's not how I trained you. I raised you better than that, sorry. Right? No, we go, that was a big boo-boo. And how can I enter into this with you so that we can move forward financially in a way that honors God and is good for you? How do we do that? I'm gonna enter into this, and people are gonna see that I'm doing that. I'm gonna shame myself because, man, this is not a good spot. I don't want you to be here. And people are gonna hear about me identifying myself with you in this problem, so that I can gain your heart back. What about the good son? What might that look like? Many of us maybe have children in here who are good people. And maybe they're like running for office, or maybe they're in high political positions, or they're running a great company, and they're good people. They're good people. They're not bad people. They're good people. And as you enter into their life and they talk about what they're doing and how good everything's going, one of the things that I hear a lot, and certainly kind of is being cultivated in my family, at least from other parts of my family, is when I hear about some of my friends who are doing good out there, some of my family members will say things like, man, they're doing really good for themselves. I go, wow, that's great, that's good. And I hear about all the good things that they're doing, and I have to ask the question, but see, this story divides people into bad people and good people, but that good people have a problem too. And it might be their goodness. Their goodness is getting in the way of God's grace because they don't need anything. So maybe it would look like for us as fathers or grandfathers or as parents is if we have good children and they tell us about how good things are going, we shame ourselves in the midst of them and they say, wow, you're sure doing a lot better than I am. And we allow ourselves to be vulnerable and not try to one-up them and say, oh, you're doing that? Well, remember what I did? You know how good I am? And we play this goodness game with them. Maybe as they're telling us about how good they are, we allow ourselves to be vulnerable and say, man, I'm not that good. Let me tell you about who I am. And we allow ourselves to be shamed so as to possibly win an opportunity to tell them about the gospel. I don't know what it looks like. All I'm saying is the love of the Father shows us in the story as an incredible window to the cross. That there's two ways to break our Father's heart, by being incredibly bad or incredibly good. And that the Father's response to that is to enter into the shame of their sons, to possibly win an opportunity to get their hearts back. And it's really up to the son, it's up to the daughter, it's up to the kid, whether or not they're going to receive that, whether or not they're going to be transformed by that, whether or not they're going to be so shocked by that, that they would let their father have influence in their life again. Okay, that's the picture and that's the pattern. And what we're going to do over the next couple of weeks is explore that love of the Father for the lost son that was very, very bad, and the love of the Father for the lost son that was very, very good. And my prayer for us is that we would let God do what God really can only do, that he would point out to us which son we are, and we would see our Father shaming himself for us so as to win an opportunity to speak into our lives again. Let's have the worship team come up and close us out in worship. As they're doing that, getting ready to lead us out in worship, please, if you haven't taken the time to fill out the connection card, please do that. If you haven't put any prayer requests on there, please do that. If you have any questions about our time together this morning, about Luke 15, 11 through 32, love to spend some time with you. We're going to be going there for the next couple of weeks. So if it's kind of a textual question, I'd say hang on to it. But something's grabbing your heart, you say, man, I've never thought about it that way. I'd love to talk with you. So let's stand. Let's prepare ourselves to sing.
Take these hands.
Take these hands. I know they're empty, but with you they can. B is for beauty in your perfect plan. All I am is yours. Take these feet. I know they stumble, but you use the weak. You use the humble, so please use me. All I am is yours. I give you all my life. I'm letting it go. I'll every sacrifice. No longer my own. All I am is yours. All I am is yours.
Take this heart.
Take this heart. Set it on fire, shining in the dark. I want to tell the world of who you are. All I am is yours. I give you all my life. I'm letting it go. I'm letting sacrifice. No longer my own. All I am is yours. All I am is yours. I give you everything. I belong, every beat of my heart, the breath in my lungs, all I am is yours, all I am is yours. I lift my hands up, God, I surrender, all that I am for your glory, your honor, your fame. All I am is yours. I give you everything. To you I belong. Every beat of my heart, the breath in my lungs. All I am is yours. All I am is yours. In
the story of the father with the two lost sons, my prayer for us as God's people is we would leave here with a fresh sense of God's grace, God's love, that he's willing and wants to identify himself. He wants to enter into our shame to perhaps win our hearts back. Another way to say it is that he enters into our shame and he hopes that we see what he's doing. There's only one son in the story that sees what his father has done. and it changes him. And the other son doesn't see it. My prayer for us as God's people is that we would go out transformed by this so that we can give that love to our kids. They could see what we're willing to do to enter into their shame, and they would see it, and it would change them, and we'd be able to speak into their lives again. Have a great week. Have a great week. Enjoy the story. Meditate on it together.